from deep inside your radio.
I guess it isn't here. Ladies and gentlemen, from the Le Show Dome, from the world headquarters of this very program. First of all, this is a story that will curl your recently straightened hair. The hair straightening company Brazilian Blowout says it started legal proceedings against Oregon's Occupational Safety and Health Division. Why? Because Oregon has issued a warning about formaldehyde in Brazilian Blowout. Oregon OSHA warned hairstylists that the Brazilian Blowout and other hair straighteners could contain high levels of the suspected carcinogen. The company has now issued a statement saying it's suing Oregon OSHA for punitive damages. Brazilian Blowout says the agency fails to distinguish between formaldehyde and methylene glycol. Oh, well, it's only methylene glycol. Oregon OSHA Director Michael Wood says methylene glycol is simply formaldehyde in solution. He says our standards are clear. The practice of industrial chemistry is clear. The practice of toxicology is clear. This product contains formaldehyde. As I say, if you're trying to straighten your hair, that could curl it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you have seen in the media ranging from the most respectable mainstream media to the most respectable fringe conspiracy media, a focus on the new security procedures. Hey, let's have that music already. There we go. Tales of airport security kind of thing. A concentration on the new pat-down procedures at airports where the new full-body scanners have been introduced. What has not been concentrated on by these media is the scanners themselves. And so in today's Tales of Airport Security, we do that, starting with this statement from Dave Bates, the president of the Allied Pilots Association, which represents 11,000 pilots of American Airlines.
We have advised our pilots to opt out, and what that means is not to subject themselves to the full body scan and instead get the physical full body pat down. Our pilots sometimes have to go through this 3-4 times a day over many years. There's some concern about the radiation that you are going to receive over the course of your career, in addition to the radiation that we already know we receive by flying long distances at high altitudes. They promised us almost 10 years ago that after 9/11 that they were going to go to a biometric system of identifying crew members so that we wouldn't have to be subjected to this this kind of intrusive scan or pat down.
Now, the head of the pilot union at U.S. Airways advises his members not to go through the body scanners. The reason? Health-related. The union leader said pilots shouldn't submit to the repeated doses of radiation. They should opt for the pat-down with a member of the pilot's crew witnessing. And then there's this. A group of scientists at University of California, San Francisco. We are writing to call your attention to serious concerns about the potential health risks of the recently adopted whole-body backscatter X-ray airport security scanners. This is an urgent situation, they write. Our overriding concern is the extent to which the safety of this scanning device has been adequately demonstrated. This can only be determined by a meeting of an impartial panel of experts that would include medical physicists and radiation biologists. An important consideration is that a large fraction of the population will be subject to the new X-ray scanners and be at potential risk. This raises a number of red flags. The physics, they write, of these X-rays is very telling. They are Compton scattering off outer molecule bonding electrons and thus inelastic, likely breaking bonds. Unlike other scanners, these new devices operate at relatively low beam energies. The majority of their energy is delivered to the skin and the underlying tissue. Thus, while the dose would be safe if it were distributed throughout the volume of the entire body, the dose to the skin may be dangerously high. In addition, it appears that the real independent safety data do not exist, these scientists from UC San Francisco write. A search ultimately finding top FDA radiation physics staff suggests that the relevant radiation quantity has not been characterized. Don't even know what that means, but our colleagues at UCSF, dermatologists and cancer experts, raise specific important concerns. A, the large population of older travelers, particularly at risks from the mutagenic effects of the X-rays. B, a fraction of the female population is especially sensitive to mutagenesis, provoking radiation leading to breast cancer. The population of immunocompromised individuals is likely to be at risk for cancer induction by the high skin dose. The risk of radiation emission to children and adolescents does not appear to have been fully evaluated. Because of the proximity of the testicles to skin, this tissue is at risk for sperm mutagenesis. Have the effects of the radiation on the cornea and thymus been determined? There are a number of red flags they continue to write related to the hardware itself. Because this device can scan a human in a few seconds, the X-ray beam is very intense. Any glitch in power at any point in the hardware that stops the device could cause an intense radiation dose to a single spot on the skin. As long-standing UCSF scientists and physicians, we have witnessed critical errors in decisions that have seriously affected the health of thousands of people in the United States. These unfortunate errors were made because of the failure to recognize potential adverse outcomes of decisions made at the federal level. There has not been a sufficient review of the intermediate and long-term effects of radiation exposure associated with airport scanners. There is good reason to believe these scanners will increase the risk of cancer to children and other vulnerable populations. We are unanimous in believing the potential health consequences need to be rigorously studied before these scanners are adopted. Modifications that reduce radiation exposure need to be explored as soon as possible. We urge the empowering of an impartial panel of experts to reevaluate the potential health issues we have raised before there are irrevocable long-term consequences to the health of our country. But the national media focus on the titillating aspects of pat-downs on the breasts and the groin. Well, they're both good. Hello. Welcome to the show.
I'm standing in for Joe.
Company, she gets so restless. Would I check that?
me, I'm Missing Joe. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show with the Missing Joe in mind. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland.
News of the digital wonderland for you.
Got to be so careful where you stand in the digital wonderland.
Well, the folks who have brought you HD radio are at it again. They've brought out a new generation radio. It features images related to the station you're listening to, the songs they're playing, or the ads. That's right. For only $70, you can get a radio that gives you pictures with the ads. Don't you want that? Doesn't that make radio more like television with static pictures? Yes, it does. When transmitted by stations, the images make the receiver experience dynamic, says Ibiquity, the company that makes HD radio. Because why would they call it Ibiquity radio? When the listener tunes in a station, the logo pops up, branding the station with a graphic image. Once a song begins to play, the listener would see a preloaded image, and commercials can have related images as well. The images can be synchronized with the audio, but they must be transmitted about 30 seconds or more in advance of that particular audio so the receiver can store them for viewing. So that won't be awkward and goofy and troublesome and ultimately totally non-synchronous, will it? From Fast Company magazine, a writer who says he first heard the term Digital Wonderland on this very program now carries the ball further, points out some of the products that are called HD, even though, like HD radio, they have nothing to do with high definition anything. But HD, you know, it's good because it's HD, because it's good, because there's HD, there's Valspar paint with high def advanced color system, HD paint, HD vision sunglasses, just like high definition TVs. It says, let you see with enhanced color and clarity just like high-definition TVs, except they aren't TVs and don't have high definition. High-definition dentistry, a trademark of Robert Gerber, DDS. Jolt high-definition knit pants for juniors. And AutoGlim high-definition car wax. So it's all high-definition now. It's high-definition is go, ladies and gentlemen. Now, the new Iraq. Nine days after al-Qaeda stormed one of Baghdad's most prominent cathedrals, slaughtering more than 40 worshippers, at least a dozen Christian homes were attacked this week. Now more than any time before, Iraq's Christians are reconsidering their futures in a land where they've prospered since biblical times. It's hard to be accurate about how many are left. They numbered about 1 million before 2003, about 500,000 now. So one effect of the Iraq War is to cut the number of Christians living in Iraq in half, ladies and gentlemen. Think of it. These days, says one leader, Abdullah al-Nufali of Iraq's Christian Endowment Fund, these days it's hard to find a Christian who will tell you he wants to stay in Iraq. For thousands of years, he said, we have stood alongside other sects, fought in wars, and endured all types of disasters. And now this. What is he? Anchoring the CBS radio news? And now this? What is he? Throwing to a commercial? No, he's not. That's the new Iraq for you. Makes you proud, doesn't it? And there's news of AFA. This stuff will make you proud. Maybe a nutty thought. Maybe these are the two wars that were just sent to us to tip us off that the age of American hegemony is over. I, for one, welcome our new Chinese overlords. Anyway, from McClatchy newspapers, the Obama administration, you may have noticed this already, has decided to begin publicly walking away from what it once touted as key deadlines in the war in Afghanistan, de-emphasizing President Obama's pledge he'd begin withdrawing forces in July 2011, according to administration and military officials. Like the military hasn't been pushing for this all along since Dave Petraeus came on board. The Pentagon has decided not to announce specific dates for handing security responsibility for several Afghan provinces to local officials, working on a more vague definition of transition. You know, transition. Not vague. What a year ago had been touted as an extensive December review of the strategy will be less expansive and will offer no major changes in strategy, officials told McClatchy. We've been seeing those indications for weeks. The U.S. Central Command hasn't submitted any kind of withdrawal order for forces for the July deadline, two officials told McClatchy. U.S. officials realize conditions in Afghanistan are unlikely to allow a speedy withdrawal. Lindsey Graham on one of the Sunday Yak shows this morning, just back from Afghanistan, is now talking about 2014 as a more reasonable date. Why not 2098? Really? Another official said the administration realized in contact with Pakistani officials that the PACs had concluded wrongly that July 2011 would mark the beginning of the end of U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. That perception has convinced Pakistan's military, key to preventing Taliban sympathizers from infiltrating Afghanistan, to continue to press for a political settlement instead of military action. The administration now understands it cannot shift Pakistani approaches to safeguarding its interests in Afghanistan, with this date being perceived as a walk-away date, the advisor said. The December review, says the official, will measure progress and inside the administration perspective. Getting the idea? Take next July off. Nothing's going to happen. That's their plan. What we ultimately need in Afghanistan is good governance, says one military senior officer. Right now, there's a gap between security gains and governance. Right now. Keep the clock rolling on that one. Good governance is all we need in Afghanistan, ladies and gentlemen. Couple thousand years, that should... Pakistan is a highly volatile and combustible country right now and is at risk of having a coup from inside the military by jihadist sympathizers, according to a terrorism expert at the Brookings Institution. In an interview with Der Spiegel online, terrorism expert Bruce Riedel says Pakistan today is already in the midst of a small-scale civil war. Last year, 25,000 Pakistanis were killed or wounded in terrorism-related violence. That's just civilians. That's three times the number of civilians killed or wounded in Afghanistan in the same year. Very fragile, very volatile, very combustible country right now. In many ways, it is the strategic prize in this whole equation. Our friends, Pakistan. When asked that some people believe a jihadist takeover was already more likely in Pakistan than Afghanistan, Riedel, the former CIA officer, replied, "I don't think it's imminent or inevitable, but for the first time, it's a real possibility." Where's the al-Qaeda leadership? He says, "We shouldn't think of bin Laden as living in a cave. We believe he is in Pakistan. It's a pretty good bet." And there's more. Afghan President Karzai today, or this weekend actually, comes out publicly in an interview with the Washington Post and says this. This is Karzai, our guy. "United States must reduce the visibility and intensity of its military operations in Afghanistan and end increased special ops forces night raids because they aggravate Afghans and could exacerbate the Taliban insurgency." President of Afghanistan is saying, "Cool it. Chill, babe." Publicly. To us. Karzai, our guy. He says he wants American troops off the roads and out of Afghan homes, and the long-term presence of so many foreign soldiers will only worsen the war. shot across the bow of General Petraeus, you think? Ow, that bow. The time has come to reduce military operations, Karzai says. The time has come to reduce the presence of, you know, boots in Afghanistan, to reduce the intrusiveness into daily Afghan life. He says he's speaking out not to criticize the United States, but in the belief that candor could improve what he called a grudging relationship between the countries. He describes his own deep skepticism with American policy in Afghanistan from last year's presidential election, which he says was manipulated by U.S. officials. Of course, we have said it was manipulated by him. It's a good relationship. It's like a good marriage, isn't it? And his conviction that Afghan government corruption has been caused by billions of American dollars funneled to unaccountable contractors. I just say throw more money at the problem. Me, personally. And audio files broadcast on Afghan television this week and obtained independently by the Washington Post show election officials explicitly doctoring the results of the recent parliamentary election. The latest in a gathering storm of recriminations against the Afghan Independent Election Commission. Everything good. Everything sounds good, doesn't it? But wait, there's more. Oh, yes, there's more. Because now, ladies and gentlemen, it's news from outside the bubble. It's a cheerful little earful today, isn't it? From the Independent on Sunday newspaper in London. 3 years ago, the Taliban's control over Chak district and the 112,000 Pashtun farmers who live there was restricted to the hours of darkness. No more. In Chak, the Karzai government has, in fact, given up and handed over to the Taliban. The man from the Taliban, Abdullah, collects taxes. His men issue receipts using stolen government stationery. That district is not in war-torn Helmand or Kandahar, but in a province just 40 miles southwest of the capital, Kabul. Abdullah, with a $500,000 bounty on his head, has managed to evade coalition forces for almost 4 years. And, of course, Abdullah denies there are any foreign troops, any Al-Qaeda troops there. It's just us Taliban chickens. From McClatchy newspapers, almost outside the bubble, because nobody in Washington is aware of this reporting, for more than a year, Afghan police chief... The U.S. is spending billions of dollars to build facilities for Afghans, expanding national police, new garrisons for its army. It's a linchpin of President Obama's strategy to strengthen Afghan security forces. However, it's faltering, according to current and former U.S. officials, Afghan and American contractors, and contract documents. Dozens of structures across the country either were poorly constructed or never completed at all. Tens of thousands of Afghan soldiers who were supposed to be living in garrisons by now are still housed in tents. The stations and barracks represent a pattern repeated across Afghanistan. Construction projects are failing with such frequency, the administration's initiative to reinforce Afghan security forces could be hobbled. Hobble, hobble, hobble. General Petraeus has ordered a dramatic expansion in contracting. Other than asking a brigadier general to investigate problems with military contracts so far, he's failed to address their flaws. A McClatchy investigation has found that since January 2008, nearly $200 million in U.S. Army Corps of Engineers construction projects in Afghanistan have failed, faced serious delays, or resulted in subpar work. Poor record-keeping made it impossible for McClatchy to determine the value of faulty projects before then. In a rush to award contracts to Afghan companies, the Corps accepts bids that don't cover the cost of a project. Rather than scrap a project that's failing, the government sometimes rewrites the contract to require only the work that's been done and then declares the reward, the effort a success. The process is called de-scoping. A vast majority of the companies that McClatchy found were doing shoddy work haven't been banned from getting new U.S. contracts. And despite these challenges, the Corps' work in Afghanistan is set to more than double in the current fiscal year from nearly $2 billion from $900 million. Job well done, everybody. Says Colonel Thomas Magnus, the commander of the Afghanistan Engineer District North, there is a recognition that our construction is not keeping up with the requirements. The approach has been, in construction, ready, fire, aim. And now we want to change it to ready, aim, fire. And I think as a result of that, we'll have a higher record of success. Spoken as a person from the Corps of Engineers. This also from outside the bubble. Reaction to the release of George W. Bush's memoirs. Oh, sorry, before that. Just before that. Outside the bubble, the new head of Britain's armed forces, General Sir David Richards, has warned the West cannot defeat Al-Qaeda and militant Islam. This is from the Sunday Telegraph. He said defeating Islamist militancy was unnecessary and would never be achieved. He argued it could be contained to allow Britons to lead secure lives. Sounds like John Kerry, 2004. Contained? Where's the victory, babe? General Richards said the threat posed by Al-Qaeda and its affiliates meant Britain's national security would be at risk for at least 30 years. Now, on the subject of George W. Bush's memoirs, at least the part that he himself is responsible for, British officials told The Guardian there was no evidence to support claims by George Bush that information extracted by waterboarding saved British lives by foiling attacks on Heathrow Airport and Canary Wharf. British counterterrorism officials distanced themselves from Bush's claims. The Heathrow alert, in fact, happened a month before Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's arrest, with army tanks parked around the airport. British counterterrorism officials said Mohammed provided extremely valuable information, but that it mainly related to Al-Qaeda's structure and was not known to have been extracted through torture. And David Cameron, just the British Prime Minister, has challenged George Bush's claim that the use of waterboarding saved British lives. Said torture was wrong, and any information received as a result was, quote, very likely to be unreliable, unquote. News from outside the bubble, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Meanwhile, British media had an interview with William Taft, the chief State Department advisor to the Bush administration, on the subject of the legality of waterboarding and whether or not it's torture. And here, this week, is what he says.
I think it was most unfortunate, both in terms of the reputation of the United States for adhering to the Geneva Conventions, which it had always done and been a strong supporter of them. It put our soldiers at risk of not being treated consistent with them. And it was a breach of our responsibilities to the individual terrorists who, dreadful as they may be, are human beings and should be treated humanely. Waterboarding, to my mind, is pretty clearly torture. In fact, the United States prosecuted people in the Second World War in the Japanese military for using waterboarding, and there really had been precedent for determining that it is torture. The technique was wrong. There's no question about that. The Convention on Torture was negotiated very carefully, and the conclusion that was reached by the parties to the convention, which include obviously the United Kingdom and the United States, was that there is no valid exercise of torture, use of torture, under any circumstances whatsoever. And the convention couldn't be clearer that we have made that decision in signing up to the Convention Against Torture, that we will not do this. And there is absolutely no room there or daylight for saying, well, it's very important, or it's a different situation than we anticipated.
That's the chief State Department advisor in the Bush administration on the subject. George W. Bush in his memoirs, of course, says he approved waterboarding for three people, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and he would do it again. He also talks about an incident around the time that his mom, Barbara Bush, had a miscarriage, and he, a teenager, was enlisted to drive her to the hospital.
She trusted me. And when you're a teenage kid, you know, you're kind of self-absorbed person, and your mom says, I trust you. It's a boost in confidence. And my mom's what I learned was she's a straightforward person.
Right.
She says to her teenage kid, here's a fetus. No question that affected me, my philosophy, that we should respect life.
She hands him a jar in which his would-be sibling had been put by Barbara Bush. And she says, here's a fetus. There'll be a probable phone call regarding the George W. Bush memoir book tour from between 41 and 43, coming up moments from now here on the show.
We boarded the boat on the breast of the river so wide, and we left old St. Louis on the crest of that brown muddy tide. To the strains of the Delta Queen's band I found myself holding your hand way we had hoped we would do all that summer and fall. Oh, the whistle came out, such a deep, mellow sound in the night. And the echo came back from a shoreline of twinkling light. Nothing we really could say. The river had swept us away. Like a present hereafter, the warm sound of laughter as we danced to the Delta Queen wall. I find myself holding you near. With the nighttime unfolding, I'm lucky just having you here. As a single wave curls down the shore, we're waltzing away across the floor. As our heartbeats assemble, the boat slightly trembles as we dance to the Delta Queen waltz.
Yeah.
I got book tour Eagle. Hey, 43, just calling to say very dignified book tour. Thanks, 41. I can't say it's been easy doing all these interviews.
No, imagine not.
I mean, ask any major league batter, he'll tell you how fatiguing it is just to face junk ballers all the time.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I guess.
But I do appreciate you keying in on what we keyed in on in planning the tour, that the dignitas.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, otherwise you're just doing what so many others are doing out there, exploiting your own
celebritas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and case in pointers, Sister Palin.
Oh, sure.
I mean, if she's the mama grizzly, mm-hmm. does that make us all cubs? First of all, that's National League. And second, that's just not my idea of leadership.
No. Government is not your parent. We all know that.
I had enough of in locus parenti in college.
Not that it worked.
Sure didn't.
Hey, speaking of which, 43, uh-huh. Barr wants to thank you.
Oh, it was nothing. What's you thanking me for?
No, just the restraint you showed with the whole, you know, unborn thing.
Fetus in a jar?
Mm-hmm.
Shoot, 41. Publisher said that had to stay in.
Well, I know, but...
No, they insisted. Said you're not going out there with nothing but Andy Card antidotes.
Okay. Yeah, she's just relieved that you stayed within the agreed boundaries on the deal.
Oh, heck, I had no intention of getting into the whole making me go to a movie with the little critter and all of that.
You know, she wasn't herself and all. What with the anger and the grief. And the anger.
Yeah, I mean, making me play catch with it, I thought she was angry at me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was long before I had any insight into the human personalitas.
She'd always felt a little badly about that period.
Oh, I know it. That's why I gave credit to that incident for the change in my philosophy. I mean, nothing gives you more reverence for human life than seeing it in a jar, that's for damn sure. But, you know, I thought that would ease some of Mom's anxietas.
Now, still, man, you're rock solid on everything else, even though...
Oh, you pet your sweet bippy, I am. Heck, I'm not going to back down on my waterboarding decision just because some book critics and non-government lawyers would like me to. And if a robust defense of the Iraq War means that I sell a few more books, hey, breaks of the game.
Well, and really was almost moved by what you said about our, I guess you'd call it, relationship. Kind of like... glass more than half full type deal.
Yeah. Sort of enhanced realitas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like Laura said to me when I started having the book written, by the time you get to the point where you can settle some scores, you almost don't remember what the score is. Something like that. The ghostwriter wrote it down for me. And, you know, anyway, I've been a father now. Whatever mistakes I thought you might have made, I worked them out on my own kids.
Well, appreciated it. Made me proud that, you know, despite everything, maybe we really did raise you right.
Hey, the Lord sent me here to do a job. You didn't stand in my way.
I think even the people who hate your guts have to admire your devotion to your guts.
Thanks, 41. That's the one thing I really wanted to maintain through this whole process.
What's that?
My integritas. Mm-hmm. Hey, gotta go do Huckabee's show. Love to the jar lady.
Won't tell her that. All our love to you, 43.
Got it. Bye-bye.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
In an aggressive statement questioning the legitimacy of his two-day suspension from MSNBC, Keith Olbermann addressed his viewers this week, saying they were responsible for his scheduled return to the air. He blamed NBC for creating a donation policy that was inconsistently applied and said he did not know the rule existed. He acknowledged there should have been a conversation with NBC executives, saying his political donations to three candidates merited public acknowledgement and perhaps an internal warning. He acknowledged the episode had caused a bit of a media frenzy. Quote, "I wish to apologize to you viewers for having precipitated such anxiety and unnecessary drama." Unquote. On a related subject, Pat Sajak has apologized for something that happened when he hosted his failed national late-night talk show on CBS in 1989 and 90. He claims to have introduced the nation to an up-and-coming sportscaster named Keith Olbermann. He now apologizes for putting on the air the bitter-sounding, hate-mongering name-caller he's become, unquote, Pat Sajak, who is the executive director of conservative publishing house Eagle Publishing. I'm not sure, it says Sajak, how he morphed. He looked at the news at a kind of cockeyed angle that I enjoyed. I liked the guy, and he was always a good guest. Maybe it's just show business and trying to find a place in it and building an audience. But I don't know. We were never friends away from the show, so I can't even guess what drives him. Deadline Seattle, Washington. Washington University Athletic Director Scott Woodward has issued an apology and clarification for comments he made about Oregon over the weekend. He had said Oregon as an academic institution had become, quote, an embarrassment. He apologized if his comments were found as critical or insulting to Oregon. If. Troy Gentry of Montgomery Gentry, Country Western Group, has posted a handwritten letter on the website apologizing for what he described as the unethical method he used to kill a tame bear 4 years ago. I made a mistake, a bad decision. It has been an embarrassment to both me and my family, Gentry wrote. He said, I'm not proud of what I did. I am truly sorry. In 2006, Gentry was arrested for shooting a tame black bear on an enclosed game farm in Minnesota. He paid a $15,000 fine, served probation, was banned from hunting or fishing in Minnesota for 5 years. Don't tell the mama grizzlies. The Katy, Texas Independent School District apologized this week for enabling a political action committee to send robocalls to residents' homework and cell phone numbers before the recent election. The district was giving the numbers to a political action committee that favored a proposed bond package for school district funding. Katy residents' ire over the calls did not stop voters from approving the measure. So, moral hazard. Kyle Busch, NASCAR driver, was fined $25,000 by NASCAR for an obscene gesture, and he apologized for losing his temper. The makers of a new Toronto reality TV show have apologized for a controversial online trailer in which one of the program's characters expresses hatred for Jews, even as two former cast hopefuls alleged they felt pressured to make racist and sexualized comments during the audition process. This is a show called Lake Shore, modeled on the successful format of Jersey Shore. So they're, I guess, looking for idiots. Cartoonist Jim Davis is apologizing for a Garfield strip that some veterans may have found offensive. The strip ran Thursday in newspapers across the country. It shows a spider daring the pudgy orange cat to squash it. The spider tells Garfield if he's killed, quote, they will hold an annual day of remembrance in my honor. The final panel shows a spider teacher asking its class if they know why spiders celebrate National Stupid Day. In a statement on his website, Davis says he didn't know the strip would appear on Veterans Day, and it absolutely positively has nothing to do with this important day of remembrance. He says his brother and son served in the military. And Israel's national airline El Al this week apologized to a visiting professor strip-searched on her way to a conference in Jerusalem. Neuroscientist Heather Bradshaw was traveling from the UK to Israel when she was subjected to a physical examination in which she was asked to remove her bra. I said, her bra. She told Haaretz, not Haaretz, but Haaretz, her bra. I'm just getting hung up on that vowel, sorry. That LL security personnel detained her at Luton Airport in London, confiscated all of her belongings, and repeatedly questioned her. The examination lasted nearly an hour, and then she was reprimanded for holding up the flight. The airline apologized, promising to open an investigation and promising to compensate Bradshaw for the inconvenience caused to her and the late arrival of her luggage. Can't beat that. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's clean, it's too cheap to be safe. Peach Bottom Atomic Power Station in York, Pennsylvania, is working to repair leaks in the system where its spent fuel or radioactive waste is stored. That can't be anything to be... Plant workers recently discovered helium leaks in two casks where rods of radioactive materials are stored after being removed from the reactor. A minute, innocuous amount of inert helium is escaping from the two casks, according to the NRC spokesperson. The more problematic leak is in cask one, in which the helium is escaping from a lid seal. There is no potential for escape of radioactivity, and the amount of helium released is minute, according to the spokesman for the nuclear plant. It's just a leak. I'm sorry, didn't mean to go falsetto on you there. Deadline Kansas City, federal workers were kept in the dark about possible health risks from a plant making parts for nuclear weapons next door to their Kansas City offices, according to an inspector general's report released this week. It faults the GSA, the General Services Administration, for failing to fully investigate and report on environmental hazards at the plant where parts for nuclear weapons were made for, you know, more than 60 years. Oh, I went falsetto again. Federal regulators have faulted Westinghouse Electric for parts of its analysis of what would happen if a large airliner slammed into a proposed nuclear reactor that could be built at plants across the southeast. The NRC issued a low-level violation against Westinghouse over what regulators said were flaws in its modeling of the effects of a plane strike on the AP1000 reactor. The violation, you'll be glad to know, does not carry a fine. Utility companies had picked the AP1000 for seven proposed nuclear plants in the country. After September 11th, NRC rules require that reactors be robust enough to withstand a hit by a commercial airliner. Inspectors this fall focused on Westinghouse's crash analysis. Their report identified several concerns, including what inspectors deemed a failure to adequately consider the effects of an airline strike that hits an annex building, penetrates another structure, and heads toward an equipment hatch. NRC officials also faulted Westinghouse for failing to consider that an access door leading to a space between the concrete and steel containment building and the could fail in a crash, allowing flames to spread. So you cannot be sure if it's Westinghouse. And Entergy Corporation says its Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant has been temporarily shut down after the discovery of another radioactive leak, the latest at the aging plant that the company is trying to now to sell. The plant was shut down about 7 p.m. Sunday for what he described as a very minimal leak, 60 drops a minute, from a crack in a pipe that is part of a system feeding water into the reactor. The leak was contained and posed no threat to the public, said the plant spokesman. However, the reactor had to be shut down. He had no time estimate on when the plant would be back up and running. It's reliable, too, and clean and safe and cheap. This is the latest leak at Vermont Yankee, which supplies about a third of the state's power. This occurred as another Entergy nuclear reactor at Indian Point in the northeast near New York City was taken out of service after a transformer exploded. It's safe. It's clean. It's safe. It's clean, it's cheap, it's so lovely. It's our friend, the atom, walking out the door right now.
Open up the windows, save the AC, freed from the grip of the humidity. Time to trade your shorts for jeans, it's autumn. In New Orleans, just like the springtime, without the bugs, breezes as gentle as a grandma's hugs. Streets start filling up with tourists and teens. Autumn in New Orleans. Saints back playing, magnolias swaying, shaking off the last of last spring's beat. Party time beginning, Saints keep winning, who knows where this thing leads. Second lines start snaking up and down the street. Gloved hands clapping to the dancing feet. Friday night fish fries, white limousines. Autumn in New Orleans. hornets start bawling, duck blinds calling, darkness makes its swift return. Ghost tours romancing, Indians start dancing, soon enough the bonfires burn. So goodbye to grilling, indoors is willing, picks up a mess of red beans. And welcome back the autumn to old New Orleans. Old New Orleans.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
he's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here's your change. Here's your hope. Here's your change. The White House rewrote crucial sections of an Interior Department report to suggest that an independent group of scientists and engineers supported the six-month ban, the moratorium on offshore oil drilling, when, in fact, they didn't. This according to the Interior Department's Inspector General. Because, you know, science and transparency and the thing. In the wee hours of the morning of May 27th, the staff member to White House Energy Advisor Carol Browner sent two edited versions of the department report's executive summary back to Interior. The language had been changed to insinuate the seven-member panel of outside experts who reviewed a draft of various safety recommendations endorsed the moratorium. The White House, according to the IG report, edited the original draft executive summary, leading to the implication that the moratorium recommendation had been peer-reviewed by the experts. The IG does not make any judgment on whether the change was an intentional attempt to mislead the public or just a happy accident. The six-month moratorium became a major political issue over the summer. It has now been it was ended early by Interior Secretary Salazar. Although it was originally not scheduled to expire until this is nutty, after the election. Interior spokeswoman Kendra Barkoff said the changes were part of the normal editing and consulting process. There was no intent to mislead the public, she says. A White House official says the report only reinforces there was no wrongdoing. Three experts the IG interviewed and included in the report said it was a misunderstanding. We misunderstood. And the oil spill that damaged the Gulf of Mexico's reefs and wetlands is also threatening to stain the Obama administration's reputation for relying on science to guide policy. Academics, environmentalists, federal investigators have accused the administration since the April spill of downplaying scientific findings, misrepresenting data, and misconstruing the opinions of experts it solicited. The Interior Department's Inspector General concluded that the White House edited a drilling safety report. We've already covered that, the editing changes. Last month, staff of the Presidential Oil Spill Commission said the White House's budget office delayed publication of a scientific report that forecast how much oil could reach the Gulf shores. Federal officials, scientists, initially used a volume of oil that did not account for the cleanup efforts. The administration ultimately cited smaller amounts of oil. The same report said President Obama's energy advisor, Carol Browner, mischaracterized on national TV a government analysis about where the oil went, saying it showed most of the oil was gone. The report said it could still be there. Also, by emphasizing peer review, Browner and the head of NOAA contributed to the public's perception that the report was more exact than it was. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Two entertainment items of note. If you're in the Southern California area, Friday at Royce Hall, UCLA, Richard Thompson's Cabaret of Souls, a remarkable show. I'll be a small part of it. Judith Owen will be a big part of it, as will Richard Thompson, Deborah Dobkin, and 10 Strings from the Idlewild Arts Academy. And Saturday at McCabe's in Santa Monica, Judith Owen. And I'll play around on bass a little bit. And that, ladies and gentlemen, concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com. And it'll be just like welcoming our new Chinese overlords if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Thanks to the St. Louis Film Festival folks for a lovely screening of The Big Uneasy. News about The Big Uneasy at TheBigUneasy.com. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist of the music heard here on probably still available at HarryShearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show is on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. Join the almost 20,000 followers, won't you? The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from Santa Monica.